So I want to start a short series over the next few weeks talking about money. The elders, because of the new budget, are asking us all to stretch and reconsider our commitment to the church. Not because it's not in reaction to anything, but we didn't think it would be good stewardship of what God is calling us, the kind of church God is calling us to try to be for the city of Little Rock and for the sake of the world. And we're still in the Gospel of Luke for the next few weeks, which is really fortuitous because Jesus talks a lot about money in Luke. And not because Jesus wants preachers to have private jets or churches to build stadiums. Jesus doesn't talk about money because Jesus wants to get your money. Jesus talks a lot about money because Jesus wants to keep your money from getting you. Jesus cares about you. And so, in my time as your preacher, expect me to talk a lot about money. Again, not because I care about getting your money. I don't get like a bonus if you give more. I don't work on a quota or anything. But Jesus knows something I think we have forgotten. You ever notice how when Jesus talks about money, sometimes he names it? What's he call it? Mammon. Thank you, Jeff. He calls it mammon. He gives it a name. It's a principality and power. And here's what that means for you. Money, we're often tempted to think money is some kind of neutral commodity, right? That, you know, it just depends on what you do with it. No, Jesus would say money is not neutral. It is a principality and power that is fighting for your heart. And for some of us, it's time to start fighting back. So we're going through the Gospel of Luke, and today we're getting to the beginning of one of Jesus' more famous sermons in Luke chapter 6. It's known in the Gospel of Luke as the Sermon on the Plain instead of the Sermon on the Mount, but it's the same kind of material. And he looks at his disciples. These are people that he's healed, delivered demons from, done all kinds of stuff, and then also the 12 disciples. And Jesus says something that if you grew up in church or in the Bible Belt, you just think, yeah, that sounds right. But pay attention to what Jesus is actually saying. Look at this. Luke 6, starting in verse 20. Looking at his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. For that is how the ancestors treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you've already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how the ancestors treated the false prophets." Blessed are the poor, and woe to the rich. That's a hard pill to swallow. It's some harsh words, especially because I'm rich. And I'm preaching to rich people. Globally speaking, historically speaking, we are at the top tier of wealth. And you may push back on that, and then you may go enjoy one of the three meals a day you have every day. Or you may enjoy the fact that you can take off a day from work and still get paid. Or more than a day, a week, or 4 weeks. We are in the top tier of wealthy people in the world. We're rich. And Jesus has hard things to say to rich people today. But remember this, as we talk through this, Jesus is for us. Jesus is not against us. Jesus wants to give us something, not take something away. The word Jesus used for bless is the Greek word makario. Let me hear you say makario. It's a word that can be translated not just blessed, but some translations actually translated another word. Happy. Happy are you poor. So I guess let's start here, all us rich people. Are you happy? I was going to buy a lottery ticket for this sermon, and I thought I should just set $5 on fire. That would be just as effective. But the first time I ever bought a lottery ticket, because when I was a freshman in college, it was illegal in Arkansas, the lottery. And I went with my freshman girlfriend back to her home in Texas, and I bought a lottery ticket, because that seemed like the least of all evil things I could do now that I was 18 years old. I bought a lottery ticket and thought, maybe my ship will come in. And I'm so thankful it didn't. I didn't buy the lottery ticket for this, for an example today, because, you know, I figured somebody would say, oh, it's a sin or whatever, and it's more stupid than it is a sin, because, and this is the reason I didn't buy a lottery ticket, You know you're more likely to die on the way to buying the lottery ticket than you are to actually winning the lottery. And in, through the years, I've actually had a lot of friends who play the lottery, and they've made bargains with God about what kind of good they would do with that money, and they've even asked me to pray for them to win the lottery, which is funny on so many levels. But I never pray that prayer because of this one thing. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. Maybe you've heard about the interview that was, or the research that was done about 20 years ago by some psychologists, where they took 22 lottery winners and they compared them with 29 people who had been in tragic accidents that had cost them the use of their limbs. They were quadriplegics. And after 6 months, they compared the people who won the lottery with the people who had had these tragic accidents. And to a person, the people who were now quadriplegic, their happiness had gone up. And the lottery winners, their happiness had gone down. Maybe you heard of Jack Whitaker. Lottery winner won $315 million. And when he won, Jack Whitaker did what almost everybody in this room thinks you would do with the money when you win the lottery. He did it all the right way. He set up a foundation. He started giving millions to charity. You know, he paid off his debt and did those kind of things. I mean, he played the textbook. This is what I would do if I won the lottery, and I would do it right, and it wouldn't mess up my life. And 5 years later, after people started stealing from him, after his close relationships began to crumble because he realized they're just in it for the money, 5 years later, he said, "I wish I would have torn that ticket up. It destroyed my life." Or maybe you've heard about Jim Hayes, guy who won $20 million in the Los Angeles lottery. And he told the reporters on the LA Times the next day, he said, "I'm not going to let this money mess up my life. I'm gonna stay on top of it. I'm going to change for the better. I'm going to help out my family and friends." And then he added, "I'm definitely not going to blow the money." And then a few years later, he had to start robbing banks because all that money gave him access to drugs that he never would have had access to. And he had a high-end drug habit. After he robbed 10 banks, the FBI caught him. He was homeless, destitute, and he had to spend 3 years in prison. And Jim Haynes, after spending 3 years in prison, said, "Prison did me more good than winning the lottery ever could have." That's what Jesus is saying. He is not trying to say, you know, shame on you, rich people. Good for you, poor people. He's trying to say something that's so countercultural. And by the way, it's counterculture in every sense of the word, because every commercial you watch is not going to be saying what Jesus says. Every bank you pass, every marquee you pass, sometimes even people standing up in pulpits like this, don't say what Jesus says. Because Jesus thinks your money is not some neutral commodity. And it can actually take away the very thing you think you can get through it. Happiness. So here's a question. How are we doing on that? Are you happy? Tom Brady, the despised quarterback of the New England Patriots, after 6 Super Bowl victories, so not this latest one, he's married to the world's top supermodel. Combined, they make $76 million a year. And he goes on an interview and says, "There has to be more than this." What's he saying? He's got everything you think you want. And yet, it's not enough. Or Kobe Bryant, who by the age of 24 had already had, you know, millions of dollars, a beautiful family, beachfront mansion. And he tells Newsweek, "I don't believe in happiness." What are they saying? They've got what we think we want. And they're saying you can't get what you think you want through the means we have. But not just that. Do you know you're an incredible risk, we rich people? There was a psychiatrist named Madeline Levine who works with high-end people, people who have a lot of means and resources. And she wrote a book after working with the teens raised up in highly affluent homes called The Price of Privilege. And in it, she says, Americans' newly identified at-risk group is preteens and the teens from affluent, well-educated families. In spite of the economic and social advantages, children of influence experience among the highest rates of depression, substance abuse, anxiety disorders, so they can't sleep at night, an unhappiness of any group of children in the country. That's what Jesus is talking about. He's not He's not saying, he's not making things true. He's saying what's already true, and in your bones you know it's true. Blessed are the poor. You've been to developing countries. You've seen it. Happy are the poor. It's true. Joni Erickson Tada, the great Christian writer, talked about going to Ghana, and they went to this little church, and in it there was such joy. And at the offering, this poor woman stands up, and she says, "Welcome to our American Christian friends. Welcome to Ghana, where we have joy because we need Jesus more." You remember Jesus saying that? Saying, Paul quotes it later, "Blessed, it's more blessed to give than to receive." How many of us believe that? I remember growing up hearing that and being like, yeah, but it's kind of blessed to get too, right, Jesus? But how many of us really believe that? Jesus is either right or wrong when he says that. And either we believe him or we don't. Jesus isn't just talking about giving. He's talking about a whole life oriented around one or the other, giving or receiving, getting more or getting less, giving more or taking more. And he's trying to say one will have a happier life than the other. So the question for today is Jesus right or not? Or are you happy or not? Because Jesus is trying to give all us unhappy people something. And I think we're going about it the wrong way. So turn your Bibles to Luke chapter 12, where we're going to get to the story for today. But first, a little setup. First, Jesus is teaching, and in it, he starts talking to some people who are afraid. He's teaching probably some poor people. I'll tell you why later. In verse 4, he says, "I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid." In this verse 4, chapter 12, "Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that can do no more. But I will show you whom you shall fear. Fear him who, after your body has been killed, has authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them, not one of the sparrows, is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered." That's easier for God for some of us than others. "Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." So Jesus starts off by talking about the value of human life and how God is able to provide for him. And then he says, "Don't be afraid." Why does he say that? Why does that? That doesn't quite fit here. And then somebody interrupts him, interrupts this teaching, and says in verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus has just talked about the value of sparrows. Sparrow was the cheapest thing you could buy, like cheapest food item you could buy in the marketplace. So he's basically like using spam as an illustration at this point. And he talks about the price of sparrows, and the guy's like, 5 sparrows, 2 pennies. Yeah, that sounds about right. Hey, Jesus, why don't you talk about money now? If he's talking, by the way, about a poor food that poor people would order at a supermarket or whatever they had, marketplace back in the day. Who do you think his audience is? Poor people. He's talking to poor people. And this guy busts in with a question that's focused on greed. Most of the people that come to Jesus, they ask questions in the New Testament. Not this guy. This guy comes with a demand. And I love what he says because honestly, as a preacher, I get this. Hey, would you tell my husband in a sermon that, would you tell my wife, would you tell my kids that I wish my husband, friend, you know, spouse, you know, whoever, I wish they could hear this because they're the ones that really need it. And Jesus sees through this request and immediately replies. I love the way he replies, "Man, who appointed me to be a judge or an arbiter between you?" And then he said a verse that I think every Christian needs to sticker on their wallet or tattoo on them. He said, "A person's life, watch out," which is a phrase he uses when he's warning against false teachers. "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, because life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. There are two kinds of words he could use there for life. He uses the word Zoe, which is the word for that good life, the kind of life deep in your soul you know you want. The kind of life, Jesus says, the kind of life you really want does not consist in you owning more things. There was a well-known black preacher named E.V. Hill who worked in California, and he went to preach at a predominantly white megachurch in California. He was a guest preacher there. And he stood up and he said, this was decades ago, he stood up and he says, as I walk through your fancy building, as I walk through your parking lot and see all your nice, fancy, new, high-end cars, I think to myself, there's just one thing missing. And I'd be happy to add it on there for you. What you're missing is some graffiti. What you need is somebody to go through your parking lots and your building and just write on everything you own one single word. Temporary. Because it's not going to last. And if you bind your joy to stuff that's temporary, your joy will be temporary too. We know this. We Jesus people, we believe this, or at least we say we do. But if that's the case, why are we bent on owning so much? And have you ever noticed the stuff that we own is starting to own us? And that's why Jesus responds to this guy the way he does, with a story that's haunting and brilliant, and if you let it, can change your life and can build, give you great, great joy. In Luke chapter 12, he says in verse 16, to this guy and the people listening in, he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I shall do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. It says, the ground of a certain rich man. Now, every Jew that was listening, when they heard the word ground, they would remember, this was a promised land. This guy has his ground because God gave it to him. The Israelites were given that ground by grace. The problem isn't that the guy's rich. He has what he has by the grace of God. The problem is the guy doesn't know why he's rich. He thinks he has all that stuff for himself. The problem, he doesn't recognize all this is a gift from God. It's a gift from God. And notice what it says. He said to himself. The word there is actually the Greek word for dialogue. It's not thought. He's talking to himself. Why would he need to talk to himself? Because he doesn't have anybody else to talk to. And the question we should be asking as we read this parable is, where are all the other people in this story? This guy is all alone. To this day, in villages in the Middle East, when people are going to make a financial decision, they go to the town center and they talk it out because they know their financial futures are impacted and going to impact everybody else's. But this guy is not talking to anybody. You know, the word idiot comes from the Middle Ages. It means one who chooses to live outside the village. This guy's an idiot. He is watching out for number one. He refers to himself directly and indirectly 14 different times in three verses. He is a picture of self-absorption. He is the Kanye West of parables. Most of the people around him are starving, and he says he has no place to store his crops. And Jesus is telling this to a guy who's asking him to tell my brother to split his inheritance. And Jesus knows in that moment, he's telling this parable because he's trying to expose the thing behind the thing, which is not, you're not getting what you want. It's greed. And greed, that's something we're familiar with. And not with ourselves, but with the person we really hope can hear this sermon. In all my years of ministry, I've had people confess a lot of different stuff. I've never had anybody confess greed. Because it's hard to see greed in the mirror. Greedy people, we say things like, I just like nice things. That's what greedy people say. Or I'm a good saver. Or I'm a good shopper. 89% of Americans, a couple of years ago, they did a survey. 89% of Americans said that people were too materialistic. And in the same survey, they asked the same people, do you need more stuff? And they said, yeah, totally do. Because it's easy to see other people are materialistic. It's really hard to see in the mirror. So here's some practical things that might help you out. And again, I'm saying this because Jesus is saying this, and also because Jesus is trying to give us something. Did you know that today there are over 30,000 self-storage units in the country? 30,000. They offer about 2 billion square feet of storage. And in the 1960s, that industry did not even exist. We now spend $12 billion a year to store stuff that we cannot fit in our homes. And it's not because our homes are shrinking. The average home a few decades ago was 1,600 square feet. Today it's 2,400 square feet. And we still have to rent storage units, barns, to hold our extra stuff. This is what Jesus is talking about. We have developed a market for stuff that we can't avoid being tempted to buy, that we don't have room for, and we pay for it with money we don't even have. Jesus has something to say to us, right? We are really good at building bigger barns. Greed, it's hard to recognize in ourselves, but you can see it in other people. And that's why I love this story so much, because we hear this story and we're like, yeah, that guy's a fool. You're right, God. And then we start thinking about our own barns. Jesus is holding up a mirror. And by the way, if you own a storage unit and other people know you own a storage unit, grace upon grace. I'm not trying to single you out in a sermon. But it's real easy to New Testamentize this, right? To make it flannel graph and, yeah, you get that old guy, Jesus. But Jesus is holding up a mirror and saying, be wise about your money. Now, here's the thing. The guy in the parable hasn't done anything wrong. He's not stolen from anybody. He hasn't mistreated any workers. We would call him shrewd. We'd make him an elder. We would, right? We would call him shrewd. God calls him a fool. He talks to himself. He plans for himself. He celebrates by himself. And now he's going to die all by himself. Jesus sees this man's greed, and he tells this story, not because Jesus is trying to ruin his life, but because he's trying to save it. Jesus isn't doing this because he's trying to mess up your day. He's trying to give you something here. He sees this guy's greed and he's trying to save him. He doesn't want his money. There's no passing of the plates after this. He just doesn't want his money to get him. And that's why I love the way Jesus ends this story. Because he says, so be rich toward God. And he's reminding them of a different kind of wealth, one that does not come from stockpiling. And remember, Jesus tells this story in the context of him preaching not on money, but on fear. Because come on, isn't that how money gets us? How worried are you about tomorrow? The main reason it's hard for us to be generous, because I think everybody in this room has been generous. You've experienced the joy behind being generous. But one of the main reasons it's hard for us to be generous is because we worry about our lack of resources. We say, if we give, there won't be enough in it for me. At the heart of greed is not selfishness, it's fear. It's worry about tomorrow and that maybe God will stop providing for us. That's why we stockpile. You know what the greatest mistake this rich man made? What it was? It's in verse 19. After he builds his bigger barn, he steps back and he says, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Here's the big mistake he made and that we're tempted to make. The rich man assumed there was a correlation between the amount of stuff that he had and the amount of life he had left to live. Do you make that mistake? Do you translate savings numbers into life? We think prosperity equals security. And we all want security. That's why this storage units are growing at such a massive rate. That's why we all want just a little bit more, because we're afraid. Do you know that 20 years ago, a researcher did some looked into how many times words about fear appeared in the media, like in a single newspaper. And in one newspaper in 1994, about 2,037 times, there were fear-inducing terms that appeared in a newspaper. By the next year, it had doubled. By the year 2000, in a single newspaper, about 18,000 times. And why? Is the world more dangerous now? And think before you answer that, because I think we think it is, but is it? You ever notice how the news gets you to tune in? That it's special? Like the advertisement right before you're watching the game. News at 10 tonight. Is your cereal killing you? And you're like, what? Oh, is that a possibility? You're going to watch the news because you want to have breakfast. It's the power of fear. That's why we're greedy. Greed wouldn't exist without fear. We stockpile and hoard because we bought into the lie that the more we own, the longer we'll have to own it. And we know that's dumb, right? In our head, we know it's a mistake, but I promise you, it's one of the most seductive lies there is about money. And it's something Jesus is trying to expose today. And it's one we don't realize we even believe in until the doctor calls and tells us the test came back and it's not good. Or we get served papers. Or the wreck happens. And then you know what you should have known all along, that no amount of money can fix that. We realize our life really doesn't consist of what we own. See, Jesus isn't getting onto this guy for not planning ahead. He's getting onto this guy for not planning far enough ahead. Because now you're dead. And everybody else has your money. Not because you're generous, but because you're dead. Now who gets your stuff? Look at how Jesus actually ends this. This is a word for all of us and one that can change the way we relate to our money. He ends this by saying, therefore, Jesus said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you eat or your body or what you'll wear. For life is more than food and the body more than clothes. Consider the ravens. They don't sow or reap. They have no barns, but God feeds them. And how much more valuable you are than birds. Who of you by worrying can add a single hour to your life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest? Consider how the wildflowers grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon, rich Solomon in all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And don't set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Don't worry about it. The pagans run after all those things. And your Father knows what you need. But seek His kingdom and these things will be given to you as well. Here's a word for all us greedy people today. Do not be afraid, little flock. For your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. So sell your possessions and give to the poor. Not because he's trying to take something from you, because he's trying to give you great joy. Provide purses for yourself that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will never fail, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Jesus tells us not to get our money, but to give us Zoe, the rich, full kind of life. Imagine you're God. Imagine you're the one who clothes the grass of the field, that you feed the sparrows, and you look down and you see all the sparrows and brothers that can't get along, and the people who have a lot and the people who have a little. Imagine you're God and you're trying to give us a real good kind of life. What would you say? Because that's exactly what this story is. Not because Jesus is trying to ruin your life, but because he's trying to give you the best possible kind of life. I think God watches us on Black Fridays as we push and shove and fight each other. Literally, that's how this story starts. A brother fighting with another brother trying to get ahead. And Jesus responds telling us, watch out. Because Jesus knows what we don't. That these people that are terrified about tomorrow, not having enough, worried about tomorrow, that God is already there. God's in tomorrow. And God is already good. And at the heart of this parable is a question people in this room ask every day, and generally speaking, come up with the wrong answer. At the heart of this parable is the question, what should I do with my extra? You know, the money that I have that I don't have to have. What should I do with my extra? And maybe you don't ask that question anymore because your lifestyle has expanded step by step with your resources. Maybe your bigger barn really is a bigger barn. Chances are it's something more like an upgraded car or a nicer house or a bigger, better piece of technology. And if so, Jesus has a word for all of us this morning, not for guilt, but because He's trying to give us something. Because here's what Jesus knows that we have forgotten. Church, what you call extra, someone else would call a miracle. And some of you have been in the position, you've been blessed, you've been happy to get to see what happens when your extra gets translated into somebody else's miracle. We're going to talk more about this over the next few weeks, but for today, here's what Jesus is trying to say. If you spend your life building bigger barns, one day, they always do that. It's not a meth house, Mark. Good luck figuring that out on the podcast. If you're here today and you'd like the prayers of our shepherds, they're going to be standing in the aisles. If you would like to put Jesus on in baptism, Jesus really is the best possible way to live. Following Jesus will make you better at life and make your life better. If you'd like to put Jesus on in baptism, I'll be right down here. I would love to receive your response. If you got anything going on in your life today, maybe you'd like a shepherd to pray with you over your finances or something going on there. We would be happy to pray with you if you would go to them while together we stand and worship this good and generous God.